Welcome to the Quilt Fiction Story Guild podcast, a podcast exclusively for members of the Quilt Fiction Story Guild. Thank you for joining us, and as always, thank you for being part of the Quilt Fiction community. Now, on to the story. Birds of Paradise, a friendship album story. Eula, 1935. Part 2. Even though she's still 30 minutes away from the old home place, the scenery is becoming familiar to her. As a matter of fact, Eula is nearing the southern boundary of the Wintersets farm, the largest in Medina County. In a half a mile or so, the sprawling white house will come into sight, and with it a book's worth of memories. How many times as a young woman had Eula gathered with her friends in Mavis Winterset's front room and watched John Winterset lower a quilt frame from the ceiling via a pulley system? How many quilts had they quilted, chattering away the whole time like a flock of birds? Oh, that had been a good group of women. Mavis had been a decade older than Eula, and as such had a treasure trove of experience to draw on when Eula found herself in need of advice, quilting or otherwise. Even after she and Dan bought the farm in New Bethel, Eula always traveled back for those bees. Sometimes she misses that, being around other farm women, women whose days mirrored her own. Eula's eyes still pop open at 4:15 every morning, and she immediately begins going through her list of chores. It takes a minute before she remembers that she's got an electric stove, so no need to get up to light it, and no need to start breakfast until she hears Dan washing his face in the bathroom sink, which he usually does shortly before 6 a.m. No cows to milk, no butter to churn. She does keep hens and a garden, but neither make any grand demands on her before breakfast. But once upon a time, when her day started early and she was busy with work from sunrise to sunset, one of her greatest joys was gathering with the women from nearby farms, Mavis, June Hennessy, Dara Mulligan, Joanna Ware. They usually met in the winter months, when things were slow on the farm and they could afford a day spent at the quilt frame. It was necessary, quilting, but they could have done it at home on their own. "Many hands make light work," Mavis liked to remind them as they began, and it wasn't only the work that was made lighter. Eula's heart was lighter at the end of the day as well. "I don't think quilting would be half as enjoyable if we had all the time in the world to do it," Mavis had said at one of their bees, and all the women agreed, though none of them had ever had an opportunity to test this hypothesis. Funny, Eula thinks, to have whole mornings to give over to quilting, although there are fewer such mornings now that she's teaching, or at least fewer mornings given over to her own quilts. That's the thing about teaching. She's always making samples of this block or that, but rarely does she make a finished quilt, or even a quilt top. Maisie claims that this summer she's going to make a gigantic quilt out of all of Eula's sample blocks. "You've heard of Crazy Quilt, haven't you?" she asked when she was telling Eula about her plan. "Well, this is going to be the craziest quilt of them all." Eula smiles, remembering. Maisie had been going over a long list of summer plans, even though it was only April. You'd think the girl couldn't wait to get out of school, and she certainly talked as though this were the case. But Eula was fairly certain that Maisie liked school a lot more than she let on. A girl who was haphazard when it came to her clothes and had to be handed a comb every morning to work the tangles out of her curls, she nevertheless took pains with her assignments, printing out her letters and numbers with great care. She frequently had her compositions posted to the classroom pinboard, and although Eula counseled her against boasting, Maisie liked to point out that she was the top girl in her class, bar none. Still, if you asked her whether or not she liked school, she'd crinkle up her nose and squint at you, as though the very question was an insult. Maybe it was growing up with the passel of brothers, Eula thinks as she turns right at the crossroads just past the Schultz's cow pasture on Route 30. Eula's own brothers had worn their dislike of school as though it were a badge of honor. She's 5 miles out now, and she can see the church steeple in the distance. The sight of it, signaling as it does that she's almost home, seems to reignite all of her worries about Cora. What if Cora is truly ill? What if Delia was right, and Cora has grown too old or too frail to manage such a large house? Eula can't imagine her sister anywhere else. Where else could she go? Was there an unmarried niece or nephew who could move in with her? Did Frank or Fred have a grandson whose wife was expecting their first child? Perhaps they'd like the run of a large house in exchange for caring for their great aunt. Not that Cora would appreciate having anybody move in with her. That's always been her prime reason for not marrying, after all. Other people make too much noise. They impinge on her bird watching and her reading. How can I be expected to get through all 7 volumes of Remembrance of Things Past if there are people afoot? Eula could just hear Cora ask. If the problem is Cora's health, and if her health requires others to care for her, then the solution will be hard won. Eula shakes her head. Not only does her sister have an abiding love of birds, she rather looks like a bird herself. A tiny wren, say, or a delicate sparrow. But looks are deceiving. Cora Rhodes is like a tree planted by the water. She will not be moved. But maybe she isn't sick, Eula tells herself. Maybe Delia invited her on an outing or to a tea, and Cora feigned illness in order to escape being entertained by her older sister. The only problem with that theory is that if Cora was pretending to be under the weather, Delia would sniff that out in a second. She might not be an astute reader of ailments, but she could diagnose a personal slight from 100 yards. No, if Delia is worried, there may very well be a reason to worry. Eula presses her foot more firmly against the accelerator, and the truck lurches forward as it adjusts to a faster gait. I wish you were a horse, she tells the vehicle. If you were a horse, I could ride through these fields and be home in no time. Eula has to smile at the thought of galloping across the Alford's cornfields. She'd be quite the sight to see, that was for sure. When was the last time she'd been on a horse, or had even ridden in a horse-drawn cart? Hard to believe how much things have changed since she was growing up out here. Hard to believe how much machines have taken over their lives. Everything is so different, in ways she'd never been able to imagine growing up. Except for Cora, Eula thinks with a laugh as she turns left on Old Farm Road. Cora is still as stubborn as the day she was born. Whether that's going to help or hinder the current situation, Eula has no idea. She guesses she's about to find out.
Don't say anything! There's a peacock in the side yard.
Cora is leaning over the railing at the south side of the porch.
I was reading in the parlor when I happened to look up, and there it was, she explains in a loud whisper. I'm hoping it will be joined by its friends and relations.
Typical Cora, Eula thinks, as she joins her sister at the porch rail. No hellos or why I wasn't expecting a visit from you. No, just a whispered command to not disturb a bird. Eula has to admit it's a beautiful bird. She wonders if there's a peacock quilt block. If there's not, there ought to be. Oh, if only Mother were here. She'd scurry over to her small desk to retrieve a sheet of paper and a sharpened pencil, and the two of them would work out a pattern on the spot. You'd never guess it by her plain dress and manner that Mother loved flamboyant beauty, both in nature and in quilts. Not her own quilts, of course. Mother's quilts were practical, workaday. But Eula remembers a woman who came to Homerville every summer and always brought a trunk filled with quilts with her. Who was that? Eula can't recall her name. She was the sister of one of Mother's friends.
but she does remember the woman came from Richmond, Virginia, and that her quilts were mostly broderie purse quilts, extravagantly appliqued with bouquets of peonies and roses and magnificent birds of the likes you'd never seen. Oh, how Mother had loved those beautiful and practical concoctions. And she would surely love this peacock prancing around her yard near her beloved willow tree. "Did you ever wonder how peacocks came to be in Ohio?" Eula whispers to Cora. "Surely they must have flown in from somewhere else." "Maybe they were blown in by a big storm," Cora hypothesizes, "or they escaped from a traveling circus." She finally turns to face Eula directly. "You look hungry. Let me fix you a sandwich, and you can tell me what brings you home." Eula knows that her true home is wherever Dan is, but if she's being honest, no place feels more like home than this old house. As soon as she crosses the threshold, its familiar scent envelops her, a mix of lemon and lavender, enlivening and soothing at the same time. Cora has made very few changes since Mother's death. She freshens up what needs freshening, whether it be a new quilt to replace a worn one, or a new pillow to replace one that's gotten flat and faded. Her sewing skills are top-notch, and it has always disappointed Eula that her sister doesn't share her passion for quilt making. When she was younger, she was glad of it. Quilting was something that she and Mother had to themselves. But now Eula thinks it would be nice for Cora to come visit on occasion and sew with the ladies of the Wednesday Bee. The sisters could exchange block patterns and pieces of fabric through the mail, perhaps even work on a quilt together, each making blocks they could stitch into a top over the course of a weekend. Alas, while Cora will make a quilt if a quilt needs making, she'd much prefer to be holed up in the parlor with her books and her diary, or else walking for miles over the gentle hills and the countryside that surrounds the old farm. During the warmer months, she gardens, though not with the same passion that Mother brought to the project. Still, Eula is thankful her sister has maintained their mother's old flower beds, her delphiniums and dianthus, the irises and lilies. "You could call Cora dutiful," Eula supposes, "but it's a word that flattens her sister out. Cora takes her responsibilities seriously, but she's not one to overdo. She weeds the garden beds, wipes the baseboards with lemon oil, and airs the mattresses and rugs at the beginning of spring and at the end of fall. But when the tasks of caring for home and garden are over, Cora does exactly as she pleases, slipping into worlds she'll only ever visit in novels, and stepping out every day to explore what she explored the day before, always finding something new to please or delight her." "Delia thinks I need one of those electric stoves," Cora says as she leads Eula into the kitchen. Course, the only reason she thinks it is because Jason has a friend in Valley City who sells them. "But old Bessie here will do just fine as far as I'm concerned. Mother cooked for 8 people every day on a wood stove. It's easy enough to cook for 1 or 2. Eula takes a seat at the table. "Is Howard still joining you for supper most nights?" "Some weeks yes, some weeks no," Cora replies as she pulls a plate of sliced ham from the icebox. "He often goes to his eldest daughter's in Worcester on Sunday, and his youngest daughter's in Ashland for Wednesday supper and then church, so I don't expect him on those nights. And he spends several days a month with his sons in Cleveland. I'm surprised that old jalopy of his can take him that far. He says it won't be too long until he stays put and makes his children come to him." Cora's cheeks grow rosy as she discusses her beau, her voice more musical. Eula suddenly realizes that she's been in her sister's presence for a good 5 minutes and hasn't noticed a single thing wrong with her. Her skin and eyes are clear, her gait is sure, her silver hair, pulled back into a loose knot, is shiny. Eula receives the plate from Cora and places it on the table. "You look well," she says.
I think this weather must be agreeing with you.
A little too much rain for my liking, Cora replies as she begins slicing bread, though Mother's garden has been full of appreciation for the regular watering. Howard thinks I should revive her herb garden. Did you know his father grew medicinals in their backyard? Nothing too exotic. Chamomile, black cohosh, that sort of thing. To be honest, I didn't know Mother's garden still existed, but Howard rediscovered it.
They fall into an easy conversation about their mother's teas and tinctures. She'd believed in lemon balm for stomach upset, motherwort for muscle pain and arthritis, rosemary for headaches and insomnia. She'd grown echinacea and feverfew, rue and sweet woodruff. The pantry off the kitchen had served as a pharmacy of sorts, and the Rhodes children learned to keep all but their most severest of ailments to themselves, lest their mother go to her shelves to pull out this bottle or that. In her efforts to cure her children, Mrs. Rhodes gave little consideration to the sweetness of her remedies. Most of them, in fact, were bitter on the tongue.
But we all grew up strong and healthy, Cora points out as she pours the tea, and we were hardly ever ill. Father would say it was all that fresh farm air. That man certainly liked the smell of manure in the morning.
He surely did, Eula agrees, and I believe farm life is a good life for children. But Mother's doctoring deserves some of the credit.
Oh, I think so too, Cora agrees. And I'm so happy Howard found the old garden. I've got Mother's notes upstairs, and she had some interesting ideas about what herbs are helpful as one gets older. Once the sage gets revived, I might make some skin oil. My skin is dry as a desert these days.
It doesn't look dry to me, Eula says, taking a bite of her ham sandwich, savoring the saltiness of the meat and the bite of the mustard. It occurs to her once again that Cora seems absolutely fine, which makes her wonder what their eldest sister is up to.
When was the last time you saw Delia? She asks, quickly adding, I got a letter from her the other day, if you can believe such a thing. She sounds busy as always.
Cora looks irritated by the very mention of their sister's name.
Delia's taken to visiting twice a week, just to see if I need anything, or so she says. But between the two of us, she seems less interested in me than in the house. This old place sure is holding up, she'll say. Or, this house will outlive us both by 100 years.
I have no idea what she's going on about, but I suspect she's got something on her mind.
Eula decides against mentioning that Delia believes Cora to be ill. First, she's pretty sure that Delia believes no such thing. Clearly, Eula has been called home under false pretenses. But why? What is Delia up to?
Eula has no idea, and she has 48 hours to figure out the answer.
End of part 2 of Birds of Paradise, a friendship album novella. Tune in next week for part 3. We'll see you then.
Thanks for joining us on the Quilt Fiction Story Guild podcast, a production of Milton Falls Media, Incorporated. All rights reserved. Until next time, this is Frances O'Rourke Dow. Thank you for joining us.